I'll stand today.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development this April 8, 2015. Happy birthday, Senator Roblin.
Thank you.
Yay. I think it's worth a round of applause. Let's see. Okay. We are going to change the order of events just briefly to accommodate Senator Roblin on his birthday.
And I will
open, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3455 and let Mr. Brennan give us a little bit of an update, and then we'll invite up Representative Widener and Senator Roblin.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3455 increases the membership of the ATV Grant Subcommittee. Of the All-Terrain Vehicle Advisory Committee expands purposes for use of the monies in the ATV account to include payment for emergency services related to ATVs. We also have just received today the Dash 2 amendment to the measure. It increases the membership of the Advisory Committee itself from 14 to 16 members, adding a representative of the Rural Fire Protection District and one representative of emergency medical services providers. It does a couple other things, but I don't want to steal the thunder of our panelists.
I think that's appropriate. Thank you, Mr. Brennan. Gentlemen. Senator Widener, welcome to our committee.
You did well, Senator.
Representative Widener, welcome.
Madam Chair, thank you. You stole my thunder already. Earlier, I was going to suggest that all members, representatives at the dais, you know, because your senators are here, that you should sing happy birthday to Senator Roblin.
I'm not sure you want us to sing happy
birthday.
Yeah,
you might be frightened and run out of the room.
But thank you for the thought. Please proceed.
Well, with that, saving the ears of everybody here and keeping the dogs from howling, I will continue then. Chair McEwen and distinguished members of the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development, thank you for hearing House Bill 3455 today. My name is State Representative Jim Widener from House District 24, representing Yamhill County and Southwest Washington County. Oregon offers a wide range of diverse outdoor activities. My family and I have always been enthusiastic about recreational ATVs for both pleasure of trail riding and for hunting and playing around the farm. Like most extreme sports, ATV riding comes with real elements of danger and possibility of serious bodily injury and even death sometimes. I have worked with all concerned parties related to ATVs. We have had lengthy discussions with fire district chiefs all across Oregon. Uploaded on OLIS, you can easily find 10 letters of support for the bill. Seven of those are from rural district chiefs who couldn't make it here today. One is from the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, and the other is from EMS providers and those who operate ATV recreational facilities. From these discussions and working alongside the ATV division of the Parks and Recreation Department, we have crafted a common sense solution that has wide support from all members. This is a very simple concept. This bill will add both an EMS and fire district representative onto the ATV advisory committee as voting members. The current committee has 15 members and includes ATV dealers, ATV enthusiasts, U.S. Forest Service, law enforcement, Bureau of Land Management, Department of Human Services, State Department of Forestry, Department of Transportation, Department of Fish and Wildlife, Americans with Disability Act representative, and members from Parks and Recreation Department. This list seems to include almost every feasible association or department associated with ATVs, except for the people you call when someone's life is in danger from an ATV accident, our fire districts and EMS providers. When we talked to the involved parties, everyone agreed that fire districts and EMS should have been appointed long ago. When we talked to fire chiefs and EMS providers, they were extremely excited about this idea and felt they were long overdue for representation on this committee. Due to the extreme nature of ATV recreation and the remote locations in which recreation takes place, fire districts and EMS need to be on the committee to address increasing size, weight, carrying capacity of these ATVs being produced for recreational use. Furthermore, they need to be kept up to date on new trail development and the upcoming grants. It is essential to the safety of Oregon citizens that fire districts and EMS providers know about upcoming grants available so they can receive adequate funds to offer sufficient resources when accidents and fires occur. Due to the remote locations where these accidents occur, they need to be able to quickly and adequately traverse the difficult terrain to address the severity of the situation. Quick response with properly trained and equipped firefighters and EMTs make all the difference on the outcome of any accident. In these cases, a quick response can save injured citizens from dismemberment, disability, and even death. Unfortunately, we have been told by fire districts and EMS that they feel inadequate in response times and resources for accidents and fires started in wild terrain where ATV sports enthusiasts recreate. Having fire and EMS on ATV advisory committee will keep them informed, and all will provide invaluable input and expertise on ATV issues. Having active representation on these committees will help them acquire the information about available funds necessary for protecting Oregon ATV enthusiasts and our forest as well. The Parks and Recreation Department have worked with us, and they have found creative solutions to the fire districts and EMS who lack resources. Their solution was to draft language, including this Dash 2 amendment that we are bringing forward today, to establish an outreach program to inform law enforcement, fire districts, and EMS to available grant opportunities and to become resources to provide clarification and answers to questions about grant application processes. Again, I want to thank you for hearing House Bill 3455-2 today, and it is widely supported because it's a common-sense solution to keep Oregonians and our environment safe. We have 7 letters of support from fire chiefs and rural districts. Included in some of these are Winchester Bay, North Bay, Siuslaw Valley, Junction City, Yamhill County, Town of Yamhill Fire Department, LeGrand, and the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, amongst more that should be up on all of them.
Great. Thank you, Representative. Senator Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's really great to be in front of
for
your
being
committee
here today.
For the first time.
Thank you.
For the record, Arne Roblin, Senate District 5, which includes starts at the bridge in Charleston, Oregon, and goes to 3rd Street in Tillamook, and then over into Yamhill County and Polk County in Sheridan and Falls City. So it's a fairly large area, of which much of it is recreational. If you want to go biking, trail biking in the Coast Range, you can go over to Falls City and get pizza at the local little pizza place and then go up in the bikes and have a great time. Or you can go over to the coast and from Coos Bay to Florence, 60 miles of sand dunes and national recreation as well as state parks, all of which create opportunities for well-intended ATV riders to have a problem. And who do they call? They call our local fire districts. And as you saw, 3 of the groups listed are in that group. So you've got Winchester Bay, you've got North Bay, and you've got Siuslaw, which take up that 60 miles of coast. It's been interesting. They've had some show and tell things when they've got new equipment, especially at North Bay. They got some great ATV vehicles because when you zip out into the sand to go try to rescue someone and you don't have really wide tires for very heavy machinery, you don't go very far. And so what they have done is they've developed this new equipment that they've needed, and they've gone through and got grants and others. And in talking to a lot of my ATV people, they know that if you're going to get hurt where there's people that can get to you. And you don't plan on getting hurt, but our dunes end up having a lot of accidents when people go over the top of the dune thinking the bottom will be close by, and it's a lot farther down. And when it flips over and rolls over on them, they're stuck there. And then it's trying to figure out where they are, how to get to them, because they can't describe where they are because they've just come to the area. But these rescue people get out there, find them. People don't realize that in the dunes there's also quicksand. It's not the same that you see in the movies, but you can get yourself stuck in places that you really don't want to be for long periods of time. And then there's a lot of people who think that because the beach is a highway, you might as well go ride there until the tide comes in and you can't get away from where you are. And it takes trained people. This is a really good bill to start addressing the idea that as we develop trails, and in our dunes, we had a few hundred miles of extra trails that people have not approved of. So we've had a big fight down there recently about closing off some of those trails to AVDs and other kinds of things. But not knowing where they are, not being a part of the conversation that's going on, is really detrimental to our EMT people. So I hope that this bill will take a quick trip over to the Senate so that we can do it. The other thing I'd like to say is Representative Widener, myself, Debbie Boone, and some others who have been working on sustainability issues have a series of bills, and I was really proud of Jim for finding this particular issue and bringing it to that group, because these equipment will also be helpful in other kinds of emergencies. It's just that for this particular bill, getting on this particular board is really important. And I ask any questions you might have.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Bretta, welcome.
Thank you. Unexpectedly.
You're becoming a frequent flyer.
I got my ticket punched at the door.
Madam Chair, is this good or bad for our...
Oh, it's a good thing. It's a good thing.
Well,
welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Chair McKeon, members of the committee. Greg Barreto, House District 58. That is the opposite end of the state where we also have wide open spaces, but it's Umatilla Union in Wallowa County. And I'm here to testify on House Bill 3455. This is a common sense fix-up bill that will add EMS and fire district representative to the ATV Advisory Committee. House District 58 is home to a lot of Oregon ATV enthusiasts. We have open country, gorgeous mountains, luscious forests, which just so happens to be the most beautiful part of the state where people get hurt. HB 3455-2 is a common sense solution to this vulnerability. It will add those who deal with the rescue of injured ATV riders to the ATV Advisory Committee. This addition is long overdue and unanimously supported by EMS fire organizations from my district. It's a good bill. It should pass. I do have the letter from from the Grand Rural Fire Department. It's in OLIS. I can read it if you'd like, but to save time, we're good.
We do have quite a full agenda today, so I thank you for that, and we'll just make note that it is on OLIS, and we can go take a look at it.
And Madam Chair, if I may, the Parks and Rec have done an excellent job of getting out and communicating with law enforcement and different groups. One of the places I like to go because nobody is there, it's also the place you don't want to get hurt because nobody is there, but it's Christmas Valley. They have dunes out there that nobody knows about, and they've provided funds to have a Suburban for rescuing people. I had a buddy who put his leg down on a four-wheeler, ran himself over, compound fractures, and they had to bring actually Life Flight out there to get him out. So I would hate to see what his insurance bill was for that, but I'm sure it was not pretty for him.
Well, I thank you for bringing this forward. Does the panel have any questions? Great. Thank you so much. We appreciate you being here. We have three other people signed up to testify today. I'd like to call up Nicole Palmateer, Barrett Brown, and Tom Niemela. Right, there's a lot of activity today. There's it's a busy day in the Capitol, so please excuse all the comings and goings. Welcome.
Thank you.
You. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Nicole Palmateer here today on behalf of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, which does include our EMS Emergency Medical Services section. As the sponsors of the bill had noted, we are in full support of House Bill 3455. The role of the fire service is no longer just coming and putting out fires. It's become much broader than that. We are responding to all kinds of incidents and emergencies in all different kinds of areas. And what's being proposed here is an opportunity to allow fire and EMS to participate in conversations about the very challenging rescues that we are asked to provide. And by we, I absolutely do not mean me in any way. I mean the people that I represent. But we appreciate the work of the sponsors on this bill. We've heard from many of our fire chiefs and fire districts and departments around the state, not only about the challenges of responding to incidents perhaps that might be caused by an ATV, but also the need to use different kinds of equipment these days to get to people in different areas. As we all become more adventurous and we need help from time to time, we also have to have ways to get there as well. We're in full support of this. We support the amendments and look forward to continuing to work on this in the interim. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chair McKeon, members of the committee. My name is Barrett Brown, here, I guess, with the Lobos Motorcycle Club. We're not surprised that the proposal would have the support of the EMS and fire service professionals, but I don't think we know what the OHV community in Oregon thinks about the proposal, because the proposal hadn't come before the ATV Advisory Committee itself or any of the community organizations that that everybody involved in Oregon ATV use are aware of. So we want to reiterate the importance of making those connections with the OHV user community, because this fund is not a government program per se. There are only probably four people in the room who contribute to this fund. It's a user-generated fund from a law that I helped create 25 years ago to tax ourselves to provide these services. So I want to emphasize the importance of these legislative concepts. The sponsors need to come before the community in one form or another to so that when they come to you, you can ask, well, where's the community on this? Because we just do not want to find ourselves finding a bill and then deciding quickly, how do we respond? Should we send you all letters, or should we, you know, these issues should not become complex. The reason we oppose the bill as it's currently written primarily is the addition of the line approving expenditures for ATV-related fire emergency services at the end of the bill. Maybe it's an unfortunate result of the a couple of sessions ago when noxious weeds were added to this list. The community is very sensitive about adding authorized expenditures to this list. In the past, emergency services and first aid have almost never been turned down for a grant for equipment or support, because we support these services. They're critically important. But by adding this language, if legislative fiscal were here, they would tell you an ATV-related fire, whatever that is, wherever that is, can clean out this ATV fund with the stroke of a pen. It becomes an authorized expenditure that does not have to go through the grant process or anything else. And so our users are very sensitive to the mushrooming language of spending authority when, in this case, these services have not been denied support in the past. We would at least like the opportunity to vet that last line. The membership on the advisory committee is fine, probably reasonable, but I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you for being here.
Can we hear the panel? Should we do mine?
Sir, go ahead, and then we'll have questions of the whole panel. Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Tom Niemela. I'm a representative for the Oregon Motorcycle Riders Association, which is a statewide sanctioning body for motorbikes and ATVs, and also an Oregon representative for National Off-Highway Vehicle Conservation Council. That's a mouthful. And also a District 28 Oregon representative for American Motorcyclist Association. We recently heard about this bill, and we told our members and all that around the state about that, and the initial reaction was not very pleasant. And as my friend Barrett here had mentioned, we would really like to see, when bills like this come up, that they get bounced off the users. We're not surprised that the EMT and fire department would love to have access to this, but it could easily empty out everything, and we're really concerned about that, especially since this is users paying their own fees to recreate and so forth. In the past, the ATV committee has never turned down anything for first aid equipment for EMTs or fire departments and so forth. Without dragging this out too long, the OMRA, Oregon Motorcycle Ride Association, is very much opposed to this, because we weren't part of the game, you know, the discussion about this, and we are the users. So I would just like to emphasize, make sure that we're part of this program.
We appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. I want to address the last section of the bill, adding
the cost of emergency services provided by fire service professionals as an authorized expenditure. Because I'm a little bit confused. It seems like you said you already award grants for these purposes. Right. So either you're awarding them for purposes that are not allowed by statute, or they are already allowed. I'm just a little bit confused by that.
Maybe OPRD can fill the void.
Is there someone else you would like to have up come up to testify? They'll need to come up and identify themselves.
They don't work for me. This is a department.
Okay.
So, I mean, you might.
If someone would like to step back, we could certainly have them come up.
Back.
Yeah. Thank you. Sir, thank you for joining us. Please enlighten us.
Okay. My name is Ron Price. I'm the ATV program coordinator for State Parks. Mm-hmm. And what we have issued grants in the past for us, if you look at the laws that we read now, it says first aid. We've done it under first aid. Mm-hmm. So basically what this does is it brings the first aid is kind of an old term. Emergency medical services is a new term. Basically the same thing as far as what we were thinking anyway. And, you know, they aren't represented on the committee, but the law enforcement that we do have on the committee work hand in hand with them all the time and always speak for the emergency medical services and those folks on the grant committee.
Other questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to speak to this House Bill 3455? Then I will close the hearing on House Bill 3455. And we're going to reorder a bit. I believe we have some people with some constrained time frames to transit. I'm not sure if it's north or south, but I would like to open a hearing on House Bill 3405. And I will turn to Mr. Brennan to give us an update and then turn it over to Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3405 requires the governor to consult with Metro prior to appointing members of the Board of Directors for TriMet. It establishes a task force on the Portland metropolitan area mass transit to evaluate opportunities to improve mass transit services in the Portland metro area. It has an emergency clause that would take effect upon passage. We have in your packet and on OLIS the -1 amendment that adds a definition for the terms occasional user of mass transit services, regular user of mass transit services, and transit-dependent user of mass transit services, and also modifies the membership and duties of the task force that would be created by the measure.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. Vice Chair Gorsuch, would you like to present from here, or would you like to go
ahead?
All right, thank you.
Then I can see everybody. did we want to bring up those two?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have two people that have to leave right away. So.
Great, thank you. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. I'm not going to pronounce this properly. Is it Evan or Even? Moore and Nicole Phillips. Yvonne? Avon. Thank you. Avon Moore and Nicole Phillips. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Please go ahead and get you out.
Okay. So, can you hear me okay if I talk like this?
You're fine. And you don't need to really lean forward. They're very sensitive mics.
So, Chair McEwen and members of the committee, my name is Avon Moore, and I am a member of Bus Riders Unite. We are a grassroots, all-volunteer advocacy group that represents the transit riders of the Portland metro area, with a particular focus on low-income riders, people of color, and people who are transit-dependent. I am testifying in support of this bill. It was my group that first floated the idea of the bill. So definitely a full supporter and originator. Currently, the governor is responsible for appointing members of the TriMet board. And while we know that the new governor, Kate Brown, cares about transit, she has lots of other things on her plate. The governor has 312 positions to appoint and very limited capacity to do so. This is going to be inevitable in an office this busy, and it's been the case for a while. One unfortunate situation that has resulted from this is that we've had an empty seat on the board for 2 years, meaning that the entire district of Southwest Portland and Beaverton is unrepresented. Our reliance on the governor to appoint the transit board is unique in this country. Only one other major transit board is chosen entirely by the governor, and that's in Boston, which is the state capital. It's where the governor is. Boston's transit agency is also a part of the State Department of Transportation, so they have extra levels of oversight. What this means to us is that we need to have a conversation about geography. And from this conversation, we hope to see more accountability and more transparency emerge. Involving local government in the appointments process makes it more accessible to TriMet riders, the people most impacted by the decisions that the board makes. Currently, this process takes place out of the sight of the public. BRU did some research on this, and we calculated that here in Salem, the average time spent on considering each board candidate is 6 minutes. While we are sure that there's, you know, behind-the-scenes vetting, those 6 minutes are the only opportunity for the transit riding public to weigh in. That's why we think that Metro taking the lead role in this conversation about how to move forward is appropriate. I can take a bus to the Metro office in 20 minutes. TriMet riders can meet Metro staff. We can make suggestions. We can attend events. It's a regional agency with representation from and transit planning responsibility for the entire service district. As a region, we've outgrown the old appointment system, and we think it's time to start thinking about reshaping it to fit our present-day needs. As a group, we're proud to take a lead in this conversation, and we look forward to working in good faith with the task force that's established. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee.
Hi. Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Nicole Phillips. I'm also a member of Bus Riders United. Since joining BRU and TIAC, which is TriMet's Equity Advisory Committee, I've had more opportunities than the average transit-dependent rider to interact with various board members. I can't say that we're buddies, but I think we've all had a chance to develop a snapshot of each other. And to be honest, I don't bear the current board any animosity. We, Opal, and TriMet are in the process of redefining our relationship, and I've seen and greatly appreciated TriMet's willingness to consider what we say on behalf of transit riders. If things continue as they are, I would hope that this burgeoning relationship continues. Which, of course, brings the question, why am I here before you today supporting a process change to the board appointments? The answer is a second question. Are we creating and sustaining the best group possible to represent and make decisions for the citizens of TriMet? And the honest answer, not so much. Board appointments are handled an hour away by someone unaffected by the effects of her decisions. And working within a larger framework that, per the numbers I've heard today from OTA, undervalues mass transit. To date, there's a vacant seat which has been empty for 2 years. Currently, there are no meaningful requirements for the board beyond there being one regular rider. And there is, that would be Chair Warner, but he exclusively uses the MAX. Interestingly, though, he has expressed in private conversation an interest in increasing rider representation in TriMet decision-making. None of the directors have, to the best of our knowledge, been transit dependent, despite the fact that they make up 20% of TriMet's constituents and are the majority of boardings each day. There is currently one woman on the TriMet board, even though women comprise a majority of transit riders and have different travel behavior and needs than men. And notably, there are no disabled members on the board. Although we know that people with disabilities rely disproportionately on public transit. I could point out more examples, but the point is this. The decision makers at TriMet do not reflect the constituency of TriMet. The current process was created for a different time and a different place, for a different constituency. The proposed task force would first and foremost be more representative of TriMet's riders. Second, a task force whose makeup reflects the Tri-County area of today removes the perceived barriers of disconnectedness and the actual barriers of distance, making accountability real for transit riders. Honestly, when I appear before the board, I don't see any reflection of myself as a transit-dependent rider. The time is now to open a dialogue and modernize the appointment process.
Thank you,
ma'am. Vice Chair Gorsuch. Since they have a time constraint, if you have any questions.
Are there questions for?
I guess I have one.
Yes, Representative McLean.
Did you say that you were on a citizen group that is actually part of the board process?
No, TIAC is actually an executive committee working to ensure that TriMet's decisions, planning, and everything are equitable.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Great. Ms. Moore and Ms. Phillips, thank you so much for taking the time to come down here today. You are welcome to be excused if you would like, and we can have Vice Chair Gorsuch give his testimony, or you're welcome to stay, whatever works into your schedule.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You should probably leave the desk.
Representative Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, good afternoon. So I'm going to do a little bit more presentation on House Bill 3405. This is, for the record.
Thank you.
Yes, I forgot. For the record, I'm Chris Gorsuch.
Patrick was poking me. I knew it was coming.
There you go. Chris Gorsuch, State Representative, District 49, which is East Multnomah County. So House Bill 3405 really does two things. It adds Metro to an existing list of city and county governments that the statute already directs the governor to consult with as part of the TriMet Board appointment process. Since their exclusion seems to be an oversight, we ask that the task force that we was referred to before be created to ensure that other appropriate local control authority hasn't been missed. The TriMet Board is for all intents and purposes, I know that some people, as was expressed here, have some problems with it, but overall I think it's a good board, and but like with anything, it could be improved. And so we hope that with some refinement, we'll bring the selection process for people serving on that very important board a little closer to the ridership. It seems unusual that Metro, which is a body that plans transportation and is elected by the people that are served by TriMet, doesn't currently play a consulting role to the governor, as cities and counties already do. So that seems to be an oversight. I also want to make it clear we're not, I am not here to criticize the agency or to call for directly elected boards. That's not the goal here. What my goal is to try to make the local control voice a little clearer and to make the agencies better. So the leadership at TriMet has done a lot of very good things in terms of their management of the organization. Some notable achievements in the recent past, projects that have come in under budget. They also, after a long and arduous process, were able to come to, I think, a decent labor agreement with their drivers. So those are positive pieces, and they are taking some steps towards dealing with some of the other monetary issues that the agency faces. So the board is a place where it should be the voice of the public. They really are there to balance human interests with the more objective management decisions that any agency would have. So currently, under the governor's appointment process and the Senate's confirmation, we do have, even with somewhat of a diffuse participation by cities and counties in the region, a fairly removed process, as the one young lady pointed out before, certainly removed from TriMet commuters. So bringing in an additional local component that not only improves the ability of customers to affect the appointment process, it also means that the riders who actually travel by bus, by MAX, by WES, the streetcar, can speak with a centralized body that is a part of the selection process. So, while TriMet certainly is an integral part of the city of Portland, it does have some issues in terms of, for instance, in my district, there are some issues about service alignments and so forth. Some of those things are currently under review by the agency, but we do also hear many stories where reaction time by the TriMet Board is not necessarily very good. We'll also have some other folks testifying, such as Jared France, who is from the OPAL organization, which was alluded to before, to talk more about that. So A consulting role for the Metro Council in the board process will help inform the agency's response to growth in a more considerate and transparent manner and with a regional view. And that's the important thing, because while cities and counties have the ability to say, and are supposed to be, actually by statute, talked to by the governor when a process is going on for appointment, they do not have the regional perspective for which Metro was created in the first place. And so having cities and counties plus Metro as part of the consultation process, I think, makes a more logical approach. And again, it does not interfere with the official acts of the governor or the state senate. Right. So it is interesting to note, by the way, that we do face a number of serious challenges in the city of Portland. Well, transit across the state faces challenges, but certainly Portland. Portland, I don't know if you knew this, in a recent Time magazine article, Portland was ranked 10th in traffic congestion in the United States, whereas our population is 29th. So we are facing some very daunting challenges, and having the most, you know, well-connected board to the actual people that use the service, I think, is the key goal here. So thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gorsuch, for your testimony. We have, I believe, 5 more people to testify, okay. So we'll go ahead through those two panels. Any questions for Representative Gorsuch? Representative Lively.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gorsuch, so currently I'd like to understand the number of board members, and is there any guidelines or and if guidelines is the correct term, mm-hmm. but from the standpoint of where the governor selects districts to cover yes. geographic areas?
Yes, that's right. In the statutes that lay this out, there are various districts across the TriMet service area. And so people have to be, to serve on the board, they're serving for a particular that geographic district. Area. And then there are some issues around the types of transit that they themselves use. Mm-hmm. The one problem is that right now, I think it's the board chair that is the only one who really is a somewhat regular user. But yeah, so it's not just a serving at large sort of situation.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
I would like to call Matt Marquis, Mary Longoria, and Jared Franz, please. And then we'll have one panel after this. Thank you for being here. Welcome to our committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Matt Marquis representing the Transit Union today. I'll keep my comments very brief. I'm here more for moral support for Mary. It's her first time testifying. So I am in support, though, of House Bill 3405 and be happy to answer any questions. But with that, I am going to turn it over to Mary and let her sit.
Thank you. Thank you for being here.
You bet. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am Mary Longoria, Financial Secretary of Amalgamated Transit Union, Local 757. I am here to testify in favor of House Bill 3405. This bill creates a non-legislative task force that will open up a conversation on how we can improve mass transit and also open communication to our local stakeholders. This will create a more open process and will increase local input into the appointment process, and we look forward to working with the governor's office in the future.
Great. Thank you so much. You did very well. Mr. Franz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Jared Franz. The policy.
My apologies. Franz.
The policy director at Opal Environmental Justice, Oregon. Opal builds power with low-income communities and communities of color to ensure a more fair distribution of environmental benefits and burdens in the places where we live, learn, work, play, and pray. You've already heard from some of the members of our Transit Justice Program, Bus Riders Unite, or BRU for short, and hope that you'll consider their comments as you're weighing action on this bill. What I'm here to do today is to lay a little bit more context for why now is the time to start a conversation, a more formal conversation, about updating a 40-year-old board appointment process that lacks many of the necessary considerations for accountability, transparency, and representation from those who are most impacted by the decisions that TriMet makes. This bill's not prescriptive. Other than adding Metro to the list of agencies that must be consulted by the governor, it doesn't offer policy solutions or suggestions to the problems faced by transit riders. It merely creates a task force that would formalize a conversation that is already taking place among transit riders. That conversation is, how does TriMet make decisions and who should be making those decisions? Now, the conversation about who should be making those decisions can be a contentious one, and I'll say that this bill is not about personalities. This is not about the current members of the TriMet board. In fact, many of them would be completely unaffected by the task force or the activity that would result from it. This is just about good public policy. Riders are very concerned with their level of representation and influence over the board appointment process. I'm sure many of you have heard and will hear today about recent surveys conducted by TriMet, the Attitudes and Awareness Survey, for example, that highlights people's satisfaction with TriMet. What's important to keep in mind when you hear about that survey, however, is that it was a general population survey. It was not necessarily a survey focused on riders that gave extra weight to the people who use the system most. In fact, only 19% of the people who were part of that survey classify themselves as frequent or regular riders. Those are people who ride transit at least a few times a week. So you have over 80% of the people who are part of this public opinion survey offering their thoughts, but rarely, if ever, use public transit. And most of them, in fact, use it only for recreational purposes. It was the number one response that resulted from that survey. And so you're talking about people who mostly use it to get to Timbers games or Blazers games or the Rose Festival or such. When you actually look at the opinions of the people who are using TriMet daily or several times a week, the opinions are very different. And we know this because we actually go out on buses talking to bus riders. We talk to more bus riders than any other group in town. And what we hear when we're on the bus are real concerns about who is making the decision at TriMet and wanting to formalize a conversation, wanting to move off the bus and into the halls of local government, a conversation about how we can update a 40-year-old process that doesn't meaningfully include them. We hear lots of suggestions about how that might be done. One popular one is electing the TriMet board, and I'm here to tell you today that Opal and Bus Riders Unite oppose this as an option. We're worried about the injection of money and politics into the TriMet board process, and aware that directly electing this board may result in a board that is actually less representative of the people that TriMet serves. That said, we can't simply accept the way that the process is currently done. So the point of this bill really is to get this conversation into the hands of local government, assemble a representative group of stakeholders, including riders and people who are transit dependent, to explore opportunities and options for policy changes in the future.
Thank you very much, Mr. Franz. Do we have questions for this panel? Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Actually, just to add a bit of context. So many of you probably remember that we had an audit that passed and was done by the Secretary of State's office 2 years ago. What we found was the very thing we were most interested in, which is what Mr. Franz just described, they don't do. And so that's the reason for bringing up this idea of a best practices sort of group. So, I mean, don't you think that's probably accurate?
Yeah. And we've done quite a bit of background research on how other transit boards in the country are assembled, and TriMet's situation is thoroughly unique. As you heard Avon say earlier, Boston is the only other major transit agency in the country where the governor appoints members of the transit board. But Boston, of course, is the capital of Massachusetts. The governor resides within the service district, and it's part of a larger administrative scheme that's part of the Massachusetts Department of Transportation providing additional oversight. So TriMet truly is in a unique position.
And for the record, I'd like to note that that was Mr. Franz from Opal who responded to that last question. Are there any other questions for this panel? All All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate you being here. I would like to call up Aaron Dees and John Charles, please. And if there's anyone else in the room today that would like to speak to this issue, we have one more seat at the dais, and we would invite you forward if you'd like to.
Matter, antimatter.
I got the alpha and the omega. We've got it.
Aaron, does that mean we're about to go to warp drive? That's what it kind of sounds like.
I had considered calling you up separately, but I thought, you know, we're all grown-ups here, so. Gentlemen. You are both very welcome in our committee, and we're delighted to have you here today. So, Mr. Charles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Charles, President of Cascade Policy Institute, a nonprofit policy research center based in Portland. Personally, I've lived in the Portland area since 1980. I've been a regular transit user during all of those years. I'm sure I've taken at least 25,000 trips on TriMet alone, all of their different modes. I've attended hundreds of TriMet board meetings in my life, testified dozens and dozens of times, and generally probably spent too much of my adult life inside windowless conference rooms at various meetings.
Sympathies, sir.
Yes. So I'll just focus really on page 2, line 5 and 6 here of the bill. Which is the purpose of it, I guess. The task force shall evaluate opportunities to improve the mass transit services provided in the Portland metropolitan area by the Tri-County Metropolitan Transportation District of Oregon, if that's still the version we're looking at. If it is, I would just offer a friendly amendment to Representative Gorsuch and suggest that you put a period after the word area, because it's very limiting to say the conversation is only about TriMet. I submitted testimony. It's on your old system, and if you look at it, it's got I published a report last year in which I looked at all the different public transit systems in the Portland area, the ones in Sandy, Mullala, Wilsonville, Canby. TriMet, they all have very different characteristics. I also showed the serious financial problems of TriMet, the now consistent problem of benefits costing well in excess of 100% of wages, which I've actually never heard of anywhere. That can't possibly be sustainable. And the fact that over the last 10 years they've had an increase of 80% in their operating revenue, and yet their service has dropped by about 14%, which is sort of a bureaucratic miracle, which I don't think is sustainable in the long run. So my problem with limiting the conversation to TriMet per se is that I view it as a legacy system that may just be the system of the past and not the future. And the conversation should be broader for the same reason that the Portland taxi regulators and the Portland taxi cartel are all being upended now by this invasion of Uber and Lyft and this other 21st century kind of privately financed, non-subsidized, very user-friendly system. And if you had a conversation designated only to tweak the taxi cartel to make the cartel work a little better, it would be a very boring conversation and nothing would ever change. But fortunately, Uber has decided we're operating all over the world. Why do we need Portland's permission to come in and do business? We have millions of satisfied customers. And so the fact they have invaded has forced Portland regulators to come out of their cave and change the system. And pretty soon, things will be very different in Portland. That's what happens when you allow dynamic market process to work, and we need to Uberize the whole Portland transportation economy. Not that I'm paid by Uber. I'm not. I think you've created
a new word.
Yeah, Uber.
Yes. Yeah, Uberize.
They don't donate to my organization, yeah. And I have nothing against Lyft or any other competitor to Uber. But my point, and I have never actually used Uber myself. So
okay.
I'm still getting around. I think you're testifying on the next bill, sir.
Yeah.
Hold that. John, hold
yeah, that's
that.
Right.
Right there.
You can come back to that.
I'm sorry.
So I just think that, you know, I've spent a lot of time over my career being on task forces, commissions, navel gazing exercises. And why limit the conversation to one government monopoly transit provider that enjoys being a monopoly and doesn't want anything else out there taking up the payroll tax money that comes in or competing with it? If you're going to go to the trouble to have this task force, why don't you have a real brainstorming session and talk about all the things that could happen that could peacefully coexist with TriMet, with Smart, with Chariots, the other providers, or it could actually sweep them all aside as, you know, Sony Betamax was swept aside by VHS and was swept aside by DVRs, and consumers, I'm sure most of them are pretty happy with that. So that would be my suggested amendment, sir. Okay.
Thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it. Mr. Deese?
Hi, Chair McEwen, Vice Chairs Gorsuch and Davis, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Deese, and I'm manager of TriMet's Office of Government Affairs. And thanks for having me before your committee, and happy Transit Day. I'm not going to go through the whole litany of what TriMet is, because I think Neil did that in front of your committee a few weeks ago. Highlight a couple things. We serve 25 cities, 3 counties. Metro is overlaid over the top of us. We have a very diverse constituency of folks that we service, and diverse interests. So keep that in mind. We also have about 315,000 weekday rides. So we have contact with a lot of folks. Fundamentally, the question is, what is the problem that House Bill 3405 is trying to solve? The testimony previously has spoken to a lot of issues with governance and the theory of, you know, this isn't working because of. But I'd like to go over a few things that maybe address the issue of, is TriMet doing well? One of them was the Secretary of State's audit, which Representative Gorsuch mentioned. They did cover a broad array of issues. One of I asked them recently to just give me kind of a summary of what they looked at, and they looked at the governance and management, financial condition, internal communications and labor relations, external communications and relations, operations, hiring and training. It was a many months long process. They spent hundreds of thousands of dollars in the process, and their end result was the 23 points that are there that we TriMet has already since addressed. I also provided you with a summary of what they found. I'm not going to go into it in too much detail, but it was very comprehensive. Another issue that I would like to point to is also that we've had some issues with ridership, as has the rest of the country, partly because of the recession, mostly because of the recession, probably entirely because of the recession. But our ridership is rebounding. The numbers that John referred to when he refers to service on the street, by the middle of this year, we will have more service hours on the street than we did before the recession. It takes a little bit of time to rebound. After having cut, we cut 14% of our service during the recession, which would equate to about 6 weeks of school, which would traumatize most families, which I think also gets a little bit to what my friends at Opal are having trouble with, which is making difficult decisions with lots of participants, and there's no light at the end of the tunnel. So I think there was some, you know, we have some other positives. I can, you know, wax poetic about the Portland Milwaukee Light Rail Project forever. We are coming in on time and tens of millions of dollars under budget, and this is every single project that we've done. It's pretty much been there. John might disagree a little bit. So I also put the attitudes and awareness survey that Mr. Franz commented on. You'll notice the numbers are real, and you'll also see that they are extraordinarily strong in especially the categories of who is riding. With our riders, we're very strong. With the non-riders, we're a little less strong, which I think matches. But you can also see the difference between the recession era 2013 and the 2014, after we've made a lot of changes and reflecting in the Secretary of State's audit something. I'd also like to mention that the Secretary of State's audit came about due to as a response to a similar bill to this in the last legislature, in which the result was let's do an audit to check out it, see how TriMet is doing. what do our businesses in the region think? We have an important relationship with them. TriMet was created with an appointed board, and part of the reason for that was in lore is that it was to have business representation on our board so that we would have good representation by them because they're paying 55 to 60% of our payroll tax, similar to Lane Transit District. They have the same board construct. They also have the same funding source. The business community has come with us three times to agree to raise the payroll tax on themselves, which is, I think, worth noting. We have an excellent relationship with them, and our board, I think, is a big part of that. The idea that TriMet doesn't have a very good public input, I think... they don't call the city of Portland the city that meets for nothing, and I think that we are part of that process. I think we have a diverse range of committees. We have a committee for accessible transit, which is composed of a number of folks with interested and also people with disabilities and seniors who advise us on how our MAX trains operate, how they function, what bus lines look like, where there are services that need to be improved. We have a budget task force of community members to give us input from a broad range of folks on how our budget process comes together. We have a transit equity advisory committee that was formed recently to start to try to address some of the growing equity issues that we have in America, but also in mostly in TriMet Service District, regarding moving populations, income distribution, who's living where, what sort of service we're providing. We have a transit safety education advisory committee. We have a special transportation fund advisory committee. We have a committee that has helped us work on the Portland-Milwaukee light rail alignment. We've had a committee I could go on. Metro also.
Please.
By the way.
we have a whole room of folks behind you.
Oh, okay.
Who would like to speak?
My apologies.
At some point?
Metro also conducts a whole host of other groups to help do the planning component. One of the nice parts about TriMet and Metro's relationship is that Metro does the planning and TriMet does the implementing. And we have a very strong relationship, and we do gain some benefit from having some difference between the two. I think it's also significantly important to note, as Representative Lively got to, our board members are appointed from districts. They are members of their communities. Their districts are reapportioned when the legislature does their district boundary changes. And our members are actually also citizens of the communities that they serve, and they are volunteers. I go through a few quick points about our appointed board and some of the benefits of it. There are, despite what you've heard, there are a number of boards throughout the United States for transit agencies are like unicorns. They're all different. For example, Metro in Minneapolis-St. Paul, they're appointed by their Metro-like board, which is every member of that Metro-like board is appointed by the governor. You have different boards around the state, around the country, who are appointed by city councils. You have them appointed by governors. You have them in mixes. You have some of them are elected, very few that are elected. So it's really to say that our board is vastly different than any other board, I would say that's probably true, but I would say every transit board is different than every other transit board. Couple quick points. I don't want to run too long.
Yeah, if you could begin to wrap up.
Yes, I will.
We've got two more hearings after this. Thank you.
Sorry. Sometimes I get a little carried away on the subject. Our board is, what's the best way to sum up? How about let's read this last part. We have a very proud legacy, and I think the ultimate question I'd like to ask is, what are the issues that TriMet needs to address, and we will address them? And our board will address them. We have difficulty finding those issues, but we can't find agreement on everything. And that, I think, is the fundamental issue. And Representative Gorsuch and I have spoken on this subject many times, and I think we just have a fundamental disagreement about the role of the board and the way in which the board interacts with the public. And our board takes great pride in being connected to our community. Do we agree with everything that our community brings to us, every member of our community? No, and that is just not possible. So
that's a familiar concept in this room, I think.
Yes.
Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative McLean.
First of all, this particular item here, the one that was on last time they had the audit, and I you showed us the examples of all of the things that you folks have done after that audit, and I thought this was a good summary of that. And so my question was there anything on the audit that had to do with ridership issues or with involvement of other, you know, public advisory committees?
So the 23 points there, which are the little checklist, yeah, are the 23 recommendations the audit made. And these were the areas they said. These are areas that we would suggest that you take a look at and do something with. Okay. And so there, as you'll see, areas. There are some areas regarding how we communicate with our employees and how we communicate in some transparency issues that we have since addressed. Okay. We've created a transparency website. We've with documents.
So my question is, are you still working on this list?
We're done.
Okay.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you for being here today. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this bill? This is House Bill 3405. And I'm going
I just like to make a
Representative
statement.
Lively.
So there is another.
Did you want the panel back?
No.
Okay.
So there is another board in this state. A transportation board that's appointed by the governor and happens to be Lane Transit District. And so the only reason I raise that question is we start talking about what's appropriate. It might be also appropriate to understand that over the years people have asked questions about that particular board, was appointed or not. But I just think if we're talking about a board appointed by the governor to do with transit, we should think a little larger than just this, and maybe there's a reason to look at that, and maybe there isn't. But there is another one in this state. Even it's not just in Massachusetts that there is ones appointed by the governor. That's Lane Transit District.
Would you be happier with a rounder? Something that would take in Lane as well?
My concern is only once we start talking about this issue and how what the impact it may have without having included them in the conversation.
Sure. Anyone
thank you,
Madam Chair.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Just one quick thing then. So there's two pieces to that bill, and the one piece is just adding Metro as one of the local governments. But I would certainly think that a broader discussion would be just fine. So.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I am going to close the hearing on House Bill 3405, and I'm going to open a hearing. And I think what I might do, since we have Mr. Brennan, would it be appropriate to open both of these hearings at the same time? I'm going to open a hearing on House Bill 2278 and on House Bill 2995, please. We have Representative
2237, Madam.
I'm sorry. I'm reading off something that was written in front of me. Well, that one's on Patrick. 2237. And I would like to call up Representative Davis and Representative Doherty, if they'd like to.
Why not?
Mr. Brennan, tee us up here, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Both these measures, House Bill 2237, House Bill 2995, require transportation network companies to maintain insurance policies to cover private passenger motor vehicles when the vehicle's registered owner or designated operator actively participates as a driver with a network company. They do take different approaches, and I believe that will come out in the testimony. Also, there is an amendment that is forthcoming but not yet available on House Bill 2237.
Thank you, Chair.
In any order you choose.
Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. You'll State Representative John Davis, House District 26. We now are in the exciting world of transportation network company insurance. What a day we have before us.
What a day.
You will recall that the chair appointed me and Representative McLean to take part in a work group regarding both of these bills, on House Bill 2237 and 2995. Both have the same objective, which is to make sure that when users of TNC companies, primarily Lyft and Uber, when consumers are using those services, that the drivers and the vehicles are properly insured in the event of an accident. There are three general periods that you will hear about from the industry representatives who speak after me. There's period 1, 2, and 3, but you may recall, and for those of you who've used Uber or Lyft or know about it, it is an app-based system on smartphones. The drivers are using their personal vehicles, but they become sort of commercial drivers when the app turns on. The objective of both of our bills is to provide app on to app off insurance coverage for these vehicles to make sure that both the drivers and the passengers are covered, but they get there through two different routes. In the midst of our work group, which had four interest groups, a part of the work group, it had the representatives representing the public interest. We had the taxi cartels, as we heard about earlier, over here, these guys. We had the insurance industry, which are way in the back, and they'll be coming up. And then we had the TNC companies themselves, Uber and Lyft. And of those, during our negotiations, the insurance industry and the TNC companies did reach a national settlement agreement, because this is an issue that's being discussed with great vigor in almost every state, and they were tired of fighting about it, so they reached a national settlement agreement, and I give Representative Susan McClain full credit for driving them to that national settlement, and they'll discuss that settlement with you. But with that, I'll be brief. I'll let them present it, and I'll turn it over to Representative Doherty to speak about her bill.
Welcome, Representative Doherty.
Very much, if I can make it through without
coffee. Would you like some water?
Please. For the record, my name is Margaret Doherty, and I'm the state representative for House District 35, which is Tigard and Southwest Portland. House Bill 2995 is a rather simple bill in concept, but it's very important and a very serious bill. It states that the transportation network company that operates in Oregon has to insure the vehicles itself and not pass, thank you, that responsibility onto its drivers. The term National Transportation Network Company refers to the type of taxi company that has a narrowly focused business model. Independent drivers who are often part-time sign on with the TNC to carry paying passengers. These passengers are dispatched exclusively by an app. The passengers pay through the app to the company, which in turn pays their drivers. This process is also used by most traditional taxi companies in their business model, but it includes dispatchers and payments. There really isn't a significant difference between TNCs and traditional taxi companies in what their purpose are. Traditional taxi companies are required to have primary liability insurance as well as uninsured motorist coverage. They also have other regulations such as reporting off-time traffic accidents. They also have a background check and other safeguards for the consumer. Although most of their drivers are also independent contractors, the taxi companies, not the drivers, are the ones that carry the insurance for the drivers. As a sponsor of House Bill 2995, I feel TNC should bear the same responsibility. They should not have any special privileges. We have vetted this language through the Oregon Insurance Division to ensure that it is technically correct. There's been much discussion of the insurance gap, meaning the time between on-app and off-app, and both of these bills deal with that. The bill makes it very clear that it is just from the time that the app, time is taken until the passenger has been dropped off. Traditional taxi companies are required to insure all of their vehicles, even the ones owned by their drivers, on a 24/7 basis. So the cabs are covered even when they're in the garage and being used for personal purposes, which is much different than what this is. We feel that this may not be necessary for TNCs, but I strongly believe that when vehicles are being used for commercial purposes, including waiting for passenger assignments, they must be insured by the company. Some TNCs have ignored city rules, they have defied orders, they have ignored city regulations, and this is one area that is so very, very important that they should not abrogate the responsibility of totally covering their drivers in the cars. HB 2995 levels the playing field and does not give a competitive edge to unlicensed by the city's TNCs. With that, I thank you, and I'm open for questions.
Thank you, Representative Doherty. Questions for this panel?
I did have one.
Representative McClain.
We received, and I think it was on OLIS, this particular diagram, and was that, do you know, you don't know what that one is? Okay, so
that.
Somebody else will come up and testify to it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
We do have, there we go. We have a lot of paperwork today, as you can imagine. I would like to call up the first panel, Richard Leschly, Stephen Kafori, and Dan, I'm having trouble reading this.
DeGrange.
DeGrange. Thank you so much, sir, for clarifying that. Gentlemen, welcome to our committee.
Thanks. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafori. I represent Broadway Cab, part of the taxi cartel.
Lovingly said.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm also working with a coalition of traditional taxi companies in Portland. Representative Doherty, appreciate very much the fact that she introduced our bill, and I know that she believes very strongly in the principles in this bill. Just wanted to briefly repeat what she said, that I call them TNC taxi companies and traditional taxi companies to differentiate between two business models that essentially do the same thing. They pick up people for money, they drop them off. The TNCs have a more narrow model, and that is they only use apps, but there's nothing that TNCs do that taxi companies don't do. We also use apps. We also have independent drivers who own their own vehicles. We also have some people that work part-time. We just feel that you're basically the same industry, and they ought to be treated roughly the same. Now, we've given, in this bill, an advantage to TNCs. We are not requiring them to be insured, these vehicles to be insured 100% of the time as the taxis are, and we'll hear more from that from the experts here who know more about insurance on taxis than I do. The suggestion that TNC's drivers carry their own insurance rather than the company would create an enforcement nightmare. Regulators need to see insurance certificates to ensure that the vehicles are actually insured. It's very easy to take a look at one insurance certificate. That's what happens now. Broadway cab comes in. We show them our insurance. We don't show them the insurance certificate for every single vehicle. And we think the city regulators would have an enormously difficult time trying to keep track of thousands of different vehicles, and which come and go in terms of when their insurance begins and ends. When an accident occurs, the last thing an injured person needs is a dispute over exactly who is responsible for compensating the victim. And that's the thing I showed you.
That was this.
It was a chart produced by the insurance company. Now, they will tell you that it's not viable anymore under this bill, but I think the same principle is if you know that the company is responsible, you know who to go to. And if somebody has insurance on an individual vehicle and that insurance policy has lapsed, then you've got a problem of who actually do you go after for the compensation. Finally, there's just the bottom line issue of responsibility. We believe that companies, especially those with multi-billions of dollars in value, should step up and accept responsibility for their own operations and not try to shove off those financial obligations on the people who work for them.
Thank you, sir.
My name is Dick Leschley. With Yellow Cab Taxi in Coos Bay, Oregon. I started in the industry in March of 1985 as a driver. Bought the company in September 1986. And we had two taxis. We currently have 25 taxis and a staff of about 60. Representative Doherty took all the things I was going to say.
That's perfect.
It is, isn't it? At any rate, the issue of insurance, and I'm not quite sure even why we're here, because period one, period two, period three makes absolutely no sense to a guy like me. We have a taxi cab right now in a garage in our facility that was backed into by a U.S. postal truck. Do you know how long it's going to take to settle that claim so we can get that back on the street? We are still paying insurance on that car. In fact, if we had the opportunity as an industry, and I wish you guys would take it up, that the taxi industry could go from app on to app off, because that's what we do. We log in, log out. When my driver comes to work at 6 a.m. in the morning, he logs in. When he goes home at 6 at night, he logs out. That car parked in the back. If you would give me that opportunity, we would have saved $32,000 this year. We just renewed our insurance a week ago. $32,000. I could put at least three more cars on the road and give better service to my community. Or I could make more money and go someplace on vacation. Whatever. But the point is that the real responsibility falls on the owner of the business. The owner of the business in this instance is Uber. They're worth $40 billion. They say it over and over and over again. The taxi cartel is amazing. I belong to an industry that we get three of us in a room together. We can't agree what color the wall is. I mean, and that's honest to God truth. You ought to come to our convention next year. So if you have this insurance bill, you need to have it app on to app off. Period one, if I'm a driver and I have commercial insurance and I have private insurance and I run into Caddy, excuse me, Representative McKenna, I run into her and I break her legs. Okay? So Allstate covers my private, State Farm covers my commercial. I'm going to go to State Farm, and State Farm says, well, you were in period one, you really weren't a commercial guy. And Allstate goes in, well, you were in period one, you really weren't a private guy. So how long after your leg is healed are you going to get paid? A long time. And that's the fairness issue to the public, is it's got to be seamless. It has to be seamless. When somebody gets hurt in our vehicles, which happens very rarely, they call our office, we call our insurance agent, it's handled. They don't have to go to the driver. They don't have to go three or four different ways. That's really what I have to say right now. Thanks.
Thank you, sir, for being here today.
Hi, I'm Dan.
Welcome to our committee.
Mm-hmm. And I work for Propel Insurance in Portland, Oregon. I probably should give this disclaimer. I insure all the taxi cab companies there. But I'm not part of the cartel.
All right. A fair disclaimer, sir. Thank you.
And so, Dick, had you insured with me, you would have saved that $35,000. I've been asked by some of my clients in the past to meet with public officials to address some of the concerns that city and county officials have about UberX drivers and how UberX drivers' insurance will respond in the case of a claim. In January, I met with Mayor Kitty Piercy and her risk managers to clarify these issues. After listening to my concerns, the city of Eugene disallowed UberX to provide rides in the city of Eugene. They reached this conclusion because they were frankly concerned about the safety of the general public. I'd like to take the next couple minutes to just tell you what I outlined for them. First, there are questions as to whether a personal lines policy will cover claims arising out of providing rides to the public. I don't think there's any question that they won't. I keep hearing that they're developing products, but as of today, I've read every personal lines policy that's offered in the state of Oregon, and they all have an exclusion for commercial livery exposures. In fact, I would argue that this fact has prompted Uber to modify their existing insurance policy to afford drivers nominal coverage limits from the time their app is turned on, this 1, 2, and 3, until the passenger is picked up, whereby their limits are $1 million. I believe that this change was born out of municipalities forcing them to carry higher limits or to have some commercial coverage like the taxi cab companies and the non-emergency companies have currently. I also believe that it was born out of the case in San Francisco. I don't know if you've heard about it, about a 6-year-old girl being killed by an Uber driver in transit to pick up a passenger. The public was outraged when Uber stated that even though the app was on, it was the responsibility of the driver's personal policy to pay that claim. Unfortunately, the personal policy denied that claim, and the parents of the child that was killed had to litigate and go after the personal lines carrier as well as Uber. I am pleased with the changes that Uber's made to address some of these issues, but I believe that they have to have a policy, a commercial insurance policy, that is primary, because personal line policies are simply not going to cover claims that arise out of livery applications. When UberX driver logs in, as you probably know, up to the point that they accept the trip, they only have $50,000 per limit per injury, $100,000 per accident, and $25,000 for property damage. This is very important to note because we've accumulated over the last 10 years actuarial data that will point out that 56% of all accidents, if they were taxicab companies that had this flexibility, would have happened during that period of time. In fact,
Mr. Major, I'm sorry to do this, but we have about 20 minutes. I have Representative Reed behind you to speak on another bill, and he needs to be in another meeting in about 8 minutes. So what I'd like to do, if you don't mind, is interrupt you just briefly.
Sure.
I'd like to invite Representative Reed to come up, and we'll open a hearing on his bill really briefly so he can leave, and then we'll need to start speeding this up a little bit. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2278 and 2995, and I'm going to open a hearing on, where are we? We are House Bill 2748. Briefly. Thank you, Representative Reed, for your patience.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, excuse me, I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I'm sorry for the awkwardness of this. I know how you're managing a lot of different things, and my apologies for the confusion. I just wanted to explain very briefly House Bill 2748 and our hopes and intentions for it. You'll hear from some others when that fits in your multiple priorities today. I'm, of course, continually lamenting the fact that I don't get to spend as much time with all of you on an issue that I care a lot about around infrastructure. You all know that perfectly well. You know about the gaps. You know about the financing gap. But even if we're able to address some of the financing gap, I think there's still work to do about making sure that we're using the public resources as best we can, most efficiently. Those of you who have been here before will remember that we passed House Bill 4111 in the 2014 session, which created the Public Infrastructure Commission to assess a variety of different models from around the country and around the world on how to do that. One of the real key elements of that discussion is the public-private partnership model, and the commission is doing great work. It got started a little bit late because of some difficulties making sure that we were getting the right people appointed to it. Fortunately, they are doing good work, and the bill, pay no attention to the underlying bill. Please pay attention to the Gut and Stuff -3 amendments, which I will mention just very quickly the three things those amendments do. It extends the sunset on the commission to 2016, to July 31st, 2016. It adds an engineer to the commission. As usual, we didn't get everyone on the commission who wanted to be and who has valuable things to contribute, and it transfers the administrative aspects of that to the Department of Administrative Services. I obviously care a lot about this topic and the commission. I am not, however, a member of it, but Representative Bentz is a member of it. So I imagine when you finish your other obligations and get back to this, he will have more to say. So I hope you'll adopt the -3 amendments and move it along. The bill as it exists has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but I think that's related to the underlying bill, which was obviously introduced as a placeholder. If you adopt the -3 amendments, my hope is that subsequent referral can be removed and we'll be able to extend the sunset and continue the good work.
Thank you, Representative Reed. It's very nice to have you back here today. And those of us who were here in the last session remember well what this issue entails, and we'll look forward to seeing the -3. And should it come to the floor, I'm sure you'd be willing to carry it for us. All right. Thank you so much. And I'm sorry for the delay.
Not at all.
I'm going to close the hearing on 2748 and reopen the hearing on 2278 and 2295. And Mr. DeGranger, if you'd like to rejoin us. Very quickly, we have four more people still to testify, and we have about 15 minutes to do it. So,
all right, I'll be quick. I shouldn't start?
Go ahead and just please not.
I'll
culminate,
summarize.
That would be great. Thank you.
I think the point of this bill is because we know that personal lines policies do not cover commercial exposures, we're suggesting that Uber step in and have a commercial policy like the rest of the people that they compete with. It's that simple, to protect the safety of the public. The other problem that you see with personal auto policies, to contrast that with a commercial policy, is a commercial policy, we have to provide certificates to the city, which basically indemnifies the city and protects them in the case one of our taxi cab companies have a claim. I have never seen a personal auto policy that indemnifies the city of Portland, for example. So all we're asking for is that they're insured properly. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here.
You bet.
Questions for this panel?
Thank you.
All right, gentlemen, thank you so much. I would like to call up, I think we have four left, so let's do two and two. Mr. Brine and Mr. Stefanitsis? Am I close?
Excellent, that's perfect.
Thank you. Even a blind chicken gets a kernel now and then, as my father used to say.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for being
here. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kenton Brine. I'm here on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association of America. We're a national insurance trade association with about 1,000 member companies writing property casualty insurance. About 40% of the property casualty insurance policies in force around the country today, including about 41-42% of all personal lines and commercial lines auto policies in force across the country. In the interest of time, I'm going to give you some abbreviated testimony today. As has already been mentioned by Vice Chair Davis, insurers, including my association, have come together with our colleagues at Uber, Lyft, Sidecar, and other TNCs, transportation network companies, to develop a national industry model of legislation that we can work on in states, including Oregon. There are states around the country where this legislation is currently being considered or enacted. I believe in Idaho they've enacted a bill as of 2 or 3 days ago that's on the governor's desk. Other states are in different various stages of development or consideration of legislation like this. When this debate began, for me personally, it began a little over a year ago when I was asked to testify before the city of Seattle on proposed regulations there. And many of the concerns that you've heard expressed here today are the same concerns that we expressed at those hearings. I can verify for you that personal lines auto insurance policies almost uniformly include an exclusion for livery, for the providing transportation for money. And that's one of the key points that was important to PCI when we entered into the discussion about this topic. What we have tried to do in ongoing and vigorous deliberations and negotiations with the TNCs is develop language that provides a bright line between the personal use of an automobile and the commercial use of an automobile, particular to the use of an automobile for TNC purposes. And what the draft model legislation that pretend it's here before you is going to say is that there is a bright line. Those services are defined. That what those drivers are is defined. What those companies are is defined in the model legislation. And when you do see that model, you'll see all those definitions, not completely dissimilar from the other two proposals that are before you today. The key difference is that they're not drawn in the existing insurance and car sharing statute, which is a problem for both of the bills that are currently before the committee. But also there are compromises struck between the TNCs and the insurers with respect to what's provided. And in particular, I want to make sure this is clear. What we're creating is the opportunity for a new type of insurance policy to be created. The TNC can either provide coverage on its own for its drivers during all periods, from the time the app is on, the time the driver gets in the car and turns the app on, all the way through the time they're matched with a passenger, to the time they have a passenger in the vehicle, till the passenger leaves the vehicle. During that entire period of time, there is TNC insurance. It can either be provided by the TNC company to its drivers, or it can be provided, the driver can purchase a policy on their own. It's been mentioned, I think, that those policies may not be in force in Oregon yet, but they will be, because when you build the infrastructure in the bright line, the policies will come. I read just yesterday, in fact, that ISO, which is a leading national organization that develops underwriting criteria and policy language for insurance companies, has come out with its own product that it will try to work with insurance companies to develop in all 50 states. So I think these products and services are coming, and again, they are app on to app off. The difference is from period one, which is before there's a passenger in the car, but the driver has the app on, there are lower limits than after a passenger has matched with the driver or is in the vehicle. So the limits go up. But liability insurance, uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage, and personal injury protection insurance, which is a no-fault coverage that provides medical and wage loss for anybody in the vehicle or anyone that they might strike, like a pedestrian, for example, are covered from app on to app off. And that's the critical piece for our organization, why we're supportive of the national industry compromise. I think that kind of covers what the insurance side of it is. I'd like to leave plenty of time for my colleague from Uber, but I'm obviously able to answer any questions that the committee has.
Thank you so much. Sir, welcome.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development. For the record, my name is Dennis Stefanitsis, and I'm insurance counsel for Uber Technologies. I second everything that my colleague here said. We have entered into a national agreement. It's comprehensive. In addition to the Property Casualty Insurance Association, several large national carriers such as Allstate, USAA, Farmers, the National Association of Mutual Insurance Companies, the American Insurance Association, have all joined that compromise. Those entities together make up over 1,000 companies and collectively write approximately $500 billion of premium revenue. So the compromise is very broad. It's a very, very broad coalition. The one other point that I do want to emphasize is that the coverage here will be end-to-end primary coverage, and it will specifically recognize TNC activities. And so in the event of an accident, there will be no question who is going to be the primary payer for an accident. There was some debate earlier before whatever was discussed is certainly no longer the case. Again, just end-to-end coverage by the TNC. I'd just like to point out on Bill 2995 some issues that we have with it as currently written and why we would support amending the bill to the model compromise. I don't think the definitions are as clear as they would be in the model compromise. For example, the definition, one of the definitions requires insurance when the driver's providing services. Providing could be very broad. What's important is that the TNC compromise makes clear that coverage is provided at all times while a passenger is in the vehicle until the passenger exits from the vehicle. So make sure that the passenger is completely safe. One of the other points that I think is really important to highlight is that the compromise, as my colleague emphasized, would allow for flexibility to develop new products. It doesn't require simply that there be one policy issued by the company. Personalized carriers can, if they so choose, come up with an amendment to their policy to specifically provide coverage for TNC services. So it will encourage product innovation. One other note about 2995 as currently drafted, it has some serious privacy concerns in my view. It requires the TNC to provide the driver's personal auto policy with details, date, time, start and end points of all trips while the driver's utilizing the transportation company network platform. I don't see the benefit of providing such information. I think if the goal here is that the private auto policy knows when there's an accident and that they don't need to cover it and that the TNC's insurance covers it, our model compromise bill does that by saying that in the event of an accident, the TNC and the insurer shall disclose information for the prior 12 hours and the 12 hours after an accident. So you can make sure that privacy concerns are addressed and private auto pass insurers still get the information that they need. Just want to clarify some comments were made earlier by some of the representatives here, and some of them were mischaracterizations, and I want to make clear that I'm no way suggesting they were intentional, but what a transportation network company does is it's a digital platform. So the TNC will contract with independent drivers who are independent contractors, and those drivers will then use the license the TNC platform for lead generation. So they're not actually themselves providing services. That said, TNCs do currently provide insurance for the drivers. Uber, I can speak for Uber. Uber has $1 million commercial auto liability in place, written by the James River Insurance Company, which is an A-minus rated carrier, which is excellent. And that's in place for all rides that occur on the platform. So we are already maintaining this type of coverage. The bill, I'd like to emphasize again, that will not rely on a personal auto policy. In fact, the bill specifically says that we are not going to rely on the denial, and no denial of a personal auto carrier is required. So that issue as well is taken care of. Finally, we were talking about period one, and there's a reason why the limits are somewhat lower. since the driver's using a personal vehicle, it's very different than a taxi. They're not using it on a 24-hour basis. So they're not trolling for rides. They don't need to go. We're not going to accept street hails. We don't do e-hails. So there's no need for someone to continually troll around like a taxi would do to pick up rides. The way the system works is when a rider requests a ride, the driver that's closest will automatically get pinged and have the option to pick up the rider. So there's much less risk in that period one when the app is on and there's no passenger in the vehicle. So it's substantially different exposure than a taxi would have. That said, those limits in that period are higher than the financial responsibility requirements of this state. So there is a good amount of coverage available there, and an even better amount of coverage in periods two and three when you have multiple bodies and passengers in the vehicle. With that, appreciate your time, and I look forward to your questions.
Great, thank you. Representative McLean.
Well, I have a simple question.
Sure.
Okay. Does an Uber driver have to have their own insurance for any part of periods one, two, or three?
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, Dennis Stefanis is for the record. No. The way the bill is written, the driver has an option to obtain coverage, and they might want to get broader coverage, but they do not have to. At this moment, especially, Uber is providing
coverage. No matter where your driver is during period one, which is before they've accepted a ride, you have a coverage that will cover all areas of liability, you know, collision, you know, all of those. You will be covering it for all of your drivers for all periods.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative McLean, Dennis Stefanis is again for the record. I would direct your attention to Colorado. So this bill is very similar to what
I don't know. I've researched this. I got to be on this fun committee with
sure.
John. So, you know, and I've got an Uber file and everything is that thick. I've got Lyft in there, too. And so the situation is I want just this one question answered. Does any driver that is working for the TNC, they have a choice, I know, to
sure.
lift up their insurance policy, but do they have to have an insurance policy for any part of what we've said is App 1, which is before there's a driver and a passenger, before there's been any kind of a ping or anything like that? So do they have to have insurance, or do you have full coverage for all of your drivers?
Dennis, this is for the record. Madam Chair, Representative McLean, they do not. They do not need to have additional coverage.
No, I didn't ask that. Do you cover your
yes.
drivers?
Yes, we do.
Completely from the time before they've been pinged, before they have a passenger, and before they're providing those services by your definition, which was passenger in the car or passenger delivered.
Yes. Yes, they do. Under the model bill, that will be the case. And even if the driver chooses to obtain their own insurance and for some reason it lapses, Uber will always maintain a backup policy.
I didn't ask about the backup policy. I know that's $1 million or whatever. I'm asking if they have to buy any insurance?
No.
Because that's what I want to know.
They don't.
So you're sticking by that?
Yes.
Okay.
They have coverage under Uber will be providing coverage. That's right. And they
okay.
do today.
All right, we'll talk more.
Sure.
Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony.
My pleasure.
I'll come at the same question from a different angle. In Oregon, we currently do not have this type of endorsement available. It's not approved by our insurance commissioner. So if this bill were passed and an emergency clause were on it and it became effective tomorrow, would the TNCs be required to cover during periods 1, 2, and 3?
Representative,
I think is yes.
The answer is yes, Representative
Thank
Davis.
I know you're an insurance guy. Don't get more complicated than that.
The answer is yes. That's what we've done in Colorado. Yes.
Follow up.
Yes. No, it's
at
not.
Such time as the insurance commission may approve these endorsements to personal policies. The TNC would the TNC still maintain primary coverage for drivers who choose not to have that coverage?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the case. There would be the option for additional coverage, but the TNC would always maintain that same coverage.
Thank you.
May I add to that? I believe the language of the model specifically states that in the event that the driver does not have that coverage, either because it's lapsed or they didn't purchase it, the TNC is the primary insurance coverage for periods 1, 2, and 3.
No. Any
follow-up?
Answer, ask your question.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what happens in the case of, let's say, the commissioner for Oregon, insurance commissioner
it's
for Oregon
the
says,
agreement. The
no,
agreement. Say that.
Then what do you
do? If I could, Madam Chair,
yes.
respond. policy in Oregon is that insurance policies are, I believe, file and use. They're not required to be. I mean, it would have to be rejected by the department as a as for specific reasons already stated in statute, like they're unfair, et cetera. But there's no reason why the department would reject one of these policies as an introduced policy. There's not prior approval like other states. You can actually write these policies and put them in place, and if there's a problem, the department lets you know.
Follow up?
Yes, ma'am.
So the commissioner does not have to say yes or no?
Not as a prior approval, no. They have the ability to go in and review a form filed with a policy filed in the state, and if there's a problem, they have the ability to put that on hold and require the insurer to make changes to it, or they have the ability to reject it if it's a serious problem, but they don't prior approve policies like they do in other states.
Okay. Thank you.
Everyone finished? Thank you. I do have one question. There's been I understand that both of these bills do need some work. And I believe it's my intent when we wrap this up today to pull the work group back together under the guidance of Representative McLean and Vice Chair Davis and come up with a product that I think we can all agree on is where we want to end up. I hope we can all agree. There is a lot of talk out there about a Washington model and a California model, and now I'm hearing about kind of a national agreement that's been met. I understand yesterday Portland came to some kind of a conclusion and sent out some information about a negotiation that they have been in. So I think you can understand why there are so many unanswered questions here. So I just wanted to make clear for everyone who's watching today that I don't think either one of these two bills will move forward in their current form, that we do need to work on this issue more, and it would be, I think, prudent for us to have one more meeting with the entire work group who did great work the first time, and then a number of things changed, to be perfectly honest. And I think we need to pull it back together and come up with a different draft using all the information that's happened in the last week. So a lot of things, a lot of balls in the air, I guess is a good way to put it. So thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. We are probably going to 5 o'clock today, so just be prepared.
Thank you very much for your time.
I'd like to call up Rachel Stern and John Eames, please. And please excuse me. Mr. Eames, is that...
Yes.
Correct. Thank you.
Yes.
All right. Thank you for being here today. Then we'll get our two work sessions done very quickly when we finish here.
Madam Chairwoman, committee members, my name is Rachel Stern. I'm here from the great state of Missouri to represent Lyft today. And I know my esteemed colleagues from Uber Insurance have gone in depth about what the deal looks like and how we're planning on moving forward and hoping to reach a compromise. But I just wanted to reiterate how 2995 really put sort of a kibosh on the burgeoning TNC insurance market. It's getting ahead of the market. Things are being developed. Currently, there's nothing in Oregon, but that doesn't mean in the next 3, 6, 1 year, things won't be developed. They'll allow us to take full insurance primary coverage for our drivers. So just to reiterate, 2237 needs to be amended with the compromise language. 2995, as it's written now, is working with slightly outdated information. We have reached a compromise. There's no need to quarrel over period one, period two, period three coverage. And moving forward, I feel confident that we'll come to a compromise that makes the state and TNCs all happy and helps this market. Thank you.
Thank you for traveling here today to testify. We appreciate it. Thank you so much for being here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Jonathan Eames, and I traveled all the way from Portland to be here.
You
but
lose,
I did
she
not
wins.
Take yeah. I did not take an Uber or a Lyft ride. I don't care about the underlying bill, actually, so much as I do represent. I'm here on behalf of Access to Care or Ride to Care. Mm-hmm. So they are the non-emergent medical transportation provider in the Portland metro area. They contract with both Family Care and HealthShare, the two coordinated care organizations. stations up in the Portland metro area, and in the bill, as you have in front of you on both bills, actually, there's a definition of what a transportation network company, or the term of art is the TNC, which I'm learning right now. And so what we have asked in, we actually only did one amendment. We I've actually spoken to both Representative Doherty and Representative Davis about our amendment. What would to make sure it's clear that we're not talking about a group such as Access to Care that contracts with a coordinated care organization or someone who is serving Medicaid, because that's not the intent of the bill. So we just wanted to make sure that was clear, because we use apps too, and we have some of that stuff, but it's not nearly what we're talking about here. So we have all, it's also been sent to I think the folks who are working on this bill, and they may have a word or two change, I heard, understand, but I don't think it substantially changes the bill. So if Patrick, since you have the amendment, if that would be okay we would support the -1 amendments if there's any other amendments. So whatever's the end product.
So what I understand you to say is we just need some clarification that these are very different ride opportunities.
Madam Chair, yes, thank you for testifying for me. That helps a lot. So yes, yes, that's exactly what these are. That's not the intent of the bills. So.
Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that before us. That certainly is something I had not thought of. So thank you for the clarification.
Absolutely.
Questions for this panel? Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you very much for your testimony, both of you. To clarify, are you insured?
Don't bring me into this mess. I am insured. Yes,
thank you.
I am.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, that's clear.
Any other questions for this panel? Thank you very much. I'm sorry. Representative McClain.
No, is Lyft in California?
Yes.
Okay.
We're also based out of San Francisco.
And the California model for TNCs that I saw made the company the insurance provider. And so that's what I want to know is the California model where you, the Lyft company, is the insurance provider. And can you say that that's exactly what the five other states decided to do?
I can't, but I could easily get you information on that.
I think that's going to be important for the work group.
Sure.
Because what we're looking for is the California model.
Okay. Yeah, no, thank you for that note. I absolutely will bring more information. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative McClain. And I would imagine all this information will come up when we pull our work group back together. We'll do that very, very soon. So, all right. I believe we're complete. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2278 and 2995, unless there's anyone else. Last call. All right. And I'm going to reopen the hearing on House Bill 2748. And I have on the list Ken Rust, John Charles, Tracy Rutten, please. Representative Vance, why don't you begin? I didn't have you at the top of my list for some reason.
I believe in this capacity, Chair Vance.
I believe Commissioner Vance.
Commissioner Vance.
Oh, Chair. Cliff Vance, State.
Go ahead.
Representative and then, District 60.
I believe, did John leave?
All right,
I'm happy to be joined here by my co-chair, co-commissioner, Ken Rust, who can take all the credit for all the good work that's been done, because I missed so many of these meetings. I just want to say that there remains work to be done by the commission, and I join Representative Reed in asking for the committee support in extending the time to do the work.
Thank you, so, and I believe we have an amendment to that effect. So
we do.
Thank you, Representative Benz.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair McKeown and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Rust. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the City of Portland, and I have served the city in a variety of capacities for nearly 20 years. For my entire professional career, I've been involved in the planning and execution of billions of dollars of infrastructure financing for public entities, both as a private consultant and as a public employee. I've utilized and executed a wide range of conventional and innovative financing and funding tools, and have helped negotiate complex public-public and public-private financing arrangements for publicly sponsored projects. As Representative Benz mentioned, I am currently the co-chair of the state's Public Infrastructure Commission, and for the last 6 months have been learning more about the infrastructure funding needs of the state of Oregon and its local governments. I am here today testifying in support of amended House Bill 2748 in my capacity as a local government finance officer. The City of Portland, like many local governments, is facing a large and growing backlog of infrastructure funding needs. Although the city has invested more than $2 billion in its public infrastructure over the last 20 years, its funding backlog continues to grow and is now estimated to exceed $230 million per year. Aging infrastructure, regulatory changes requiring increased investment, deferred maintenance, and providing new facilities to meet the needs of a growing population are funding challenges we faced, but these are not unique to Portland. When I meet with my colleagues around the state, I find many are dealing with the same issues, and in some cases, the scope and scale for smaller jurisdictions is even greater than what we face in Portland. Meeting the infrastructure funding needs of our local communities has been and will continue to be a significant challenge. Project costs and affordability are significant issues, as is the ability of local governments to effectively develop and manage complex projects. While financial capacity and expertise varies depending on whether you are a large government like Portland or a smaller city in rural Oregon, the fact remains that access to low-cost funding and financing tools will continue to play a critical role in addressing infrastructure funding needs. In the future, we will need to continue to look at non-traditional and innovative ways to engage the private sector in a way that leverages their project delivery expertise with the financing advantages that the public sector can offer. In my professional opinion, it is clear that there is no magic bullet that will address our infrastructure funding needs, nor will a one-size-fits-all approach meet the diverse needs of Oregon's local governments. However, I do believe that House Bill 2748, as amended, will continue efforts to more fully document the infrastructure needs facing Oregon communities, identify current funding tools and funding gaps that exist today, explore new ways to procure and deliver projects that help to attract additional capital to help finance projects, and develop recommendations that will best serve Oregonians. This is important, necessary work, and I ask for your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for being here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tracy Rutten with the League of Oregon Cities. If I would have just gone down and checked off points on my list that Mr. Russ just made, I think he hit most all of them. So out of respect for your time, I will just simply indicate our support for the Dash 3 amendments and our support for the work that's been done so far to address this issue. And on behalf of those other jurisdictions, especially those that are in rural areas and with limited resources and a lot of concern over the taxpayers and the impact that the growing infrastructure needs has on their citizens. We support this bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for being here. I think I can say to both of you that the proverbial you're singing to the choir is true here. I think we all on this committee clearly understand what our infrastructure needs are and where our deficits are, and we appreciate you supporting this bill. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Benz.
I just want to say, point out the great work that Mr. Rust has done as a co-chair of the commission. He has attended all meetings. I haven't been able to get there, and his background and efforts have been stellar. So I just wanted to thank him for his work.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you for being willing to continue if the committee so elects.
So we appreciate your service.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the hearing. I'm sorry. We have one more. Mr. Rakowitz. I would invite you to the dais. I'm sorry. Obviously, it's getting late in the day. My apologies.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Thank you for being here this afternoon.
Yes. John Rakowitz with AGC, here in support of the Dash 3 amendments, in particular the extension of the sunset of this bill. I will tell you, we have been, and I have personally been, so enmeshed in this big question. You know, are there ways to expand, enhance Oregon's ability at all levels of government to build public infrastructure? And I have never in 7 or 8 years come up against something more complex than this. We've actually taken money out of our budget to educate ourselves on this. So I really believe that the group that met this morning for 3.5 hours is really beginning to get into all the different issues associated with this. And so for that, we're really happy to support the extension of that work so that the kind of product that can be done outside of this building, the kind of recommendations, the data analysis can be brought forward and then, vetted in maybe hopefully a less complex way than the last hearing. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we appreciate your patience in staying so late in the day. On that note, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2748. And I will open a work session on House Bill 2072. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 2072, we heard on the 13th of March. Increased from 10 to 20 million the amount of total tax credits for certified film production development contributions for each fiscal year. Since we heard this bill last, we've received a Dash 2 amendment, which there was some discussion of at the previous hearing. The Dash 2 amendment expands about eligibility of reimbursement to local media production service companies, which includes the game production company.
The gaming issue.
It also adds a definition of local media production project to that end. With Madam Chair, the Dash 2 amendments to the measure, it has a minimal fiscal impact and a revenue light statement because this measure has a subsequent referral of revenue, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Brennan. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move the committee to adopt the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2072, dated 3-24-15.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Representative Davis moves to adopt House Bill 2072-2, amendment dated 3-24-15. Is there discussion? Seeing none, are there objections? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2072 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Davis moves House Bill 2072 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Chair McKeown?
Aye. The motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Revenue. And I will close the hearing, the work session on House Bill 2072 and open a work session on House Bill 2898. Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This measure, we heard the same day, it increases from $1 million to $2 million the amount of reimbursements from the Oregon Production Investment Fund to a local filmmaker and media production services company. It applies to fiscal years beginning on or after July 1st, 2015. Takes effect the 91st day after signee die. We do have, since we written it last time, a Dash 2 amendment. The Dash 2 amendment, it would extend the program to January 2024. With the Dash 2 amendment, the measure has a minimal fiscal impact and also a revenue light for this measure as well has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue.
Okay. Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move the committee adopt the House Bill 2898-2 amendment dated 4-8-15.
Representative Davis moves to adopt House Bill 2898-2 amended as dated April 8th, 2015. Is there discussion? Are there objections? If none, the amendment is adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2898 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Representative Davis moves House Bill 2898 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Mr. Brennan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to put on the record, Madam Chair, that we had a great deal of work done very rapidly by legislative fiscal and legislative revenue to get this turned around in less than 3 hours, this amendment. So I just want to give them a shout out to appreciate that we were able to move it today with quick work by LFO and LRO.
We appreciate their very good work. Duly noted. Thank you, Mr. Brennan. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Chair McKeown?
Aye. The motion passes and the bill is sent as amended to the Committee on Revenue. Is there anything else for the good of the order? I was shooting for 5 o'clock and I'm 2 minutes early. So we are adjourned. Thank you.
Very good, no
we are adjourned. Thank you.
Very good, no
I'm 2 minutes early.